Doing as part of the Latin America Review podcast with a bit more of a flexible format. And here with us today, we've got Thomas Becker, our great friend here in La Paz, Bolivia. And he is, among other things, he is the lawyer for the victims of the 2003 massacre in El Alto. And you've been here. What have you been up to here in this trip in La Paz? I know we saw you in El Alto because recently there was an anniversary for the victims of that massacre. But how's it been this past week?
Good and bad. Do I take this or
go?
I don't want to steal your thunder.
Go ahead.
Well, so first of all, it's the anniversary of Black October, so I've been with the victims. We've been having mass and doing different events, to remember what took place in 2003. Both kind of the horrible killings that took place, but also the resistance and then all the folks who rose up and basically kicked out this system of neoliberalism that's existed for way too long. Unfortunately, I've also been here meeting with victims of similar killings, the 2019 massacres in Sacaba, San Cata, in the Zona Sur of La Paz, and then other victims that were tortured. So history tends to repeat itself, unfortunately, here. And the same actors are always kind of the ones pulling it off. And they usually have skin that look a lot more like my color, you know, unfortunately.
Yeah, and we've also, yesterday marked 2 years since the victory of President Luis Arce in the historic elections in 2020, marking the formal end of the coup government. Were you in Bolivia during those elections, or were you in the U.S.?
Yeah, I was in elections, the 2019 elections and the 2020 elections.
Here in La Paz.
And I was I think maybe I saw you in the headquarters when they announced the...
In Sopocachi. So yeah, I think it's worth remembering some a bit about that day, because I remember the day of the elections was quite tense. Like, there was just military everywhere. I think it was the largest ever sort of military mobilization on an election day. I remember I went to vote with Eva Coppa when she was still part of the mass in Satélite in El Alto, which is actually where most of my family live. And that's the one area of El Alto that's right wing, that's pitita, as they say. And I remember as we went in, people throwing things at us. Someone tried to grab my, camera, my tripod and everything, tried to hit me and things like this. It was felt like it was on the knife edge. And people knew that if there was some kind of fraud or there was some kind of attempt to block the mass victory, that there would be some sort of uprising as well. And then, so I don't know if you remember, there was supposed to be an exit poll at 7 p.m. And they're on the news, any instantes, in a few minutes, it's going to come out, it's going to come out.
Yeah, yeah.
Till 9 p.m. everyone. And at that point, I fell asleep. Went back. I actually fell asleep. And then Camilla woke me up at midnight. It's wake up. Everyone's going to come on and declare victory from Argentina. I was like, what? Okay. So we turned on the TV, and there it was. We went straight down to the Mass HQ. That's where you were. Do you remember that moment of victory? Were you actually in the HQ when they declared the victory?
Yeah, so I was down the stairs and about to go up, and then I hear everybody just start screaming, and I was like, okay, now it's formally been announced. And I know Abel had announced it. I don't think he had announced it. I can't remember if he announced it yet publicly or they heard from Abel, but I went upstairs, and I do remember actually quite well what happened, because I was there, and I got a call from Patricia Arce. And so folks who don't know who Patricia Arce is, you can very easily, unfortunately, YouTube the horrible, horrible things that happened to her. She was the mayor Vinto. She was kidnapped, tortured.
A small town in Cochabamba.
Yes, just outside of Cochabamba. They dragged her through the streets, and then they filmed her as they're torturing her, you know. And they, you know, paraded her before cameras and said, you know, denounce the MAS party. And she is a powerful woman. She basically said, you can kill me, you can do whatever you want to me, but I will not denounce this process of change, which is it's really moving footage. But she called me that night, and it was, again, this is the same person who's confronted by parastate groups that are literally torturing her, and she's still standing strong. And she called me, and she was literally crying on the phone. It was the first time I'd seen her kind of in that state. And she told me, she's like, I can leave. My family can come out of hiding. I can breathe for the first time in a year.
And she's crying. I'm trying to play it cool, but I'm crying. I'm an ugly crier, so I'm like crying like a baby. But a lot of other people, I mean, it was interesting when they announced that there was a celebration, but a lot of, I noticed a lot of tears in the room because it was just like relief, not like you see, in, at least in the U.S., you see kind of like they play like Journey or Bon Jovi and there's balloons falling and all this cheesy celebration. It was not that kind of celebration. It was a, man, the dictatorship's finally over. We hope, you know, because there was a lot of fear that like in the coming days, who knows what could happen.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. I remember, I think we got the first like sound bites from Luis Arce and Chucky Wenka himself when, because they, as soon as it announced, they went up into like a room, you know, met. And then when they came down, we managed to film them and be like, what's it, you know, just like, what does it feel like? I remember Chucky Wenka was quite blunt. He was just like, yes, it's a great victory, and then walked off. But Luis Arce actually spoke for a while. And then Sebastian Michel came down. He was the head of the campaign. He's now ambassador in Venezuela. And yeah, he was on the verge of tears, basically. He's like, you know, we did this with, you know, our people in St. Catharines, St. Catharines, and mine. So that's, it's, you know, it, it means a lot, obviously. And yeah, he didn't have that sort of celebration tone. He had that more like, wow, we actually did it.
Yeah, I mean, I talked to people outside. If you remember, there was a group outside. And were like cheering, but others, like I said, were crying. And I don't know for you, but for me, over the coming days, it was still kind of like quiet. Like I thought there'd be more celebrations. But for the first few days, at least around where I was, in the center, people seemed to be kind of, at least I went around actually talking to people. That's part of it too. But I mean, like, everyday people, I was like asking them in the streets, and there was this kind of feeling of like, is this going to last, or is Anya's going to come back? And I think it's fair, because now we know, after these audios have been leaked, that, you know, the defense minister at the time had hired mercenaries to come down in case Lucho won in the 2020 elections, and they arrived. And these mercenaries are the same ones that killed the Haitian president earlier that year. So, you know, there was reason to be scared. Sure, certainly.
Yeah, definitely. One, like, not so good memory I remember is the how cold it was in La Paz at that time. It's like 2 a.m. by the time we left. It was just freezing. And sort of put a bit of a dampener on it. And, like, I went on my phone and I saw, like, all the videos of people in the Tropico just, like, going around on motorbikes, like, you know, with their flags, people, like, dancing in the streets. I was like, I'd love to be there right now.
It was, like you said, it was like 2 a.m. and it was a cold night for sure.
Yeah, but in the tropical, obviously, it's hot. It's like 35 degrees. So at night, it's actually really nice to go out. They were having an absolute party, but less so in La Paz of how cold it was.
In fairness, I think the tropical always has bigger parties than La Paz.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about that. I mean, have you ever gone to those, what they call it, the prestes? In El Alto, like in the Choles, like weddings and things like this.
Yeah, weddings last for like a day and a half. I mean, it's like...
Oh, yeah, like 2 days, 3 days, weddings. I remember we went to one in El Alto, which was like 700 people. And the family that organized it, they were like these Aymara business people in like cement or something. They ordered free beers for 700 people, free food for 700 people. Like, imagine how much money that is. And there was like, you know, Aymara, like Chicha bands playing the whole night. And it was like, wow.
Also, 700 people, like you said, like, it's not like it's like an hour-long wedding or celebration. These things go on forever. That's like quite a bit of money.
All about stamina. We also got Camila with us as well. She's been doing the setup. This is actually our first time doing it. So apologies for everyone who's looking for the earlier link. We had it set for 7 p.m. Wildly underestimated the scale of the technological challenge. So we put it back to 7:45. We still couldn't do it. And now finally we're on air. So thank you, Camila, for setting this up. It's been somewhat of a mammoth task.
So I don't think we said, I'm not sure if you guys mentioned, but tomorrow is the anniversary of the fourth time that Evo Morales was actually elected. So Evo Morales was elected on October 20th, 2019, for his fourth term. And that's really important. And that's something that I think a lot of people don't forget, because right now should be his constitutional mandate that was supposed to begin on January, the following January. And so we saw all the different things take place these days. And it was really right now, during these days of October, that the coup was taking place. Anya swore herself in closer to mid November, but it was actually during the days of October, you know, beginning at the election, but the late October, when we saw the electoral, the like TSEs, I can't remember what we call them in this country, but being set on fire, being looted, people's houses being set on fire, and that sort of vandalism. And, you know, this is what we talk about when we look at the reports of the CIDH, the Inter-American Human Rights Commission, that came here in November following the coup. What do you remember of that?
I mean, it's strange because, I mean, Bolivia's always been a complicated place. There's always been racism, but it was the most overtly racist, violent period I've ever seen in the history of Bolivia. And particularly, you know, if you think that, you know, I've worked on a case against ex-president, certainly have enemies in this country, and never had issues. When the coup happened, the number of times I've been attacked, physically, you know, assaulted in the streets by parastate groups, by even soccer moms. Yeah, I mean, like, the fascism is, it's not like fringe. It's been so normalized here. It's scary. I mean, these were scary times. Half my friends were in hiding, were in jail, were being tortured, you know, like I mentioned, Patricia Arce. But I mean, these were incredibly unprecedented violent times in Bolivia's democratic history.
Absolutely. And in the course of 2019, we at Telesur English had been reporting on, you know, the developments in the electoral campaign. And we were in touch with a number of analysts, you know, Bolivians who speak English and were able to, you know, provide us with updates on the ground, a range of people. And when I came here in November 2019, a lot of those people had already fled the country. They were forced to. And so when you guys were talking about the celebrations that took place in 2020 following the October 18th vote, these were celebrations that were being held in Buenos Aires and Mexico City and other places as well, people who weren't able to be here. And a lot of the people who were here, you know, were split apart from their friends and family members. And I saw a video, you know, from some comrades. There's several people who were with Evo there in Buenos Aires cheering, and, you know, there's all these cell phone videos, and they were having their own celebration. But it was an incredible moment. You have so many people held up at the Mexican embassy and things like that. So, I mean, it was a process of getting those people to come back as well.
Yeah, I mean, like I said, I think the moment that they said Lucho won, people kind of went, you know, and were able to breathe, like I said, like Patricia Arce said for the first time. And people started trickling back in little by little. Evo came back in November. It was not so little. It was much bigger. I mean, I saw the both of you the whole route. But when he arrived in the Tropico, I mean, I was with a journalist. I can't remember with whom, but a big international journalist. And he's like, I've covered all sorts of events. I've covered, like, U2 and these big rock stars. This is the biggest rock star event I've ever seen in my life. I mean, the Tropico is relatively small. It's not like La Paz. It's hard to get to windy roads into basically jungle. And there was, I can't remember, a million plus people in this town that's, you know, can hold, I don't know, a couple thousand. I mean, it was insane. I've never seen anything like it. Nor had this journalist who has covered these sorts of things all over the world.
Just wanted to say our first ever live chat on this stream. The lie that led to war 1951 says, hello, comrades. And he also says, mentions the ensuing massacres in Sacaba and Sencata. Now, Thomas has done a lot of work with some of the victims of Sacaba and Sencata, particularly here, you know, obviously in El Alto, you're working with the victims in 2003. have you also been working with those of 2019 as well in Sencata? Have you seen them this year, this time around?
Yes, I have. So I was in the Tropico up until earlier this last week, and then I've been with the Sencata victims as well. I should mention, I was in Sacaba the day of the massacres.
Were you? We didn't know each other.
I think, were you on the other side? Were you on the, like, line of the, like, the military basically blocked the press from being able to go into Sacaba?
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't there when the massacre took place. I was there immediately after. It was still afternoon. And I had been there the day before. And so I was at the Sacred Heart Hospital, is it? And trying to interview the doctors who didn't want to speak.
Oh, they wouldn't let...
But we did get some sound bites.
Yeah, I snuck in. Some señoras de Pollera, like, snuck me in. The doctors wouldn't let us. I mean, this was one of the problems that we saw in 2019 in Sacaba, in Sencata, is the doctors who are generally from the elite class here basically wouldn't give medical attention. I mean, it was egregious.
In Cabalos, people had to go to Cochabamba, and that's where people like, oh, you're a masista, like, it's your own fault, and stuff like this.
Absolutely.
When they're like a bullet inside them.
No, they blamed them. They said, "This, you deserve this, you deserve this." And they wouldn't give them medical attention in Viedma, in Sacaba, but also in, that's in Cochabamba. Hospital Mexico. I went to all the different hospitals where people were, and the only reason I was able to get in is because I snuck in. Because it was interesting, because the doctors were like, no, you can't. And then some, you know, person who cleans is, you know, de pollera, would say, come around here, and snuck me in. And I was able to do these interviews. And I interviewed people who quite literally, like, hadn't spoken to anyone, you know, woke up for the first time out of a coma, and were just kind of, like, confused on what happened, where am I, and just started telling me. I was there when, like, mothers and wives came and saw their loved ones dead for the first time. You know, I do human rights work all over. I've been in war zones. I've seen really bad, gruesome things. I've also interviewed, at this point, probably thousands of victims. But it was still, like, it sticks with me. I remember the moment, like, you know, the mom came in and saw her son dead for the first time, just melt into the, collapse onto the floor. And that pain was just, like, I will forever remember it.
Absolutely.
We've got a chat saying, what does Señora de Pollera mean? People haven't been to Bolivia will probably not know what that means. And that, well, it basically means indigenous woman, because in Bolivia, the traditional dress, especially in the Aymara areas of Bolivia, is this sort of long skirt, sort of layered skirt called the Pollera. So Señoras de Pollera is indigenous women. So just clearing that up.
No, thanks. That's it. Yes, thank you.
Yeah, and so in our experience, you know, we knew what was going on because the social movement people, I say we because I was with a couple other foreign journalists as well, and, you know, a lot of people who had come in that period after the swearing in, you know, the self-proclamation of Jeanine Añez, they went straight to La Paz and they didn't really go anywhere else. They didn't even go to El Alto, even though it's neighboring. And so, but we had heard that we needed to get to Sencata as soon as possible. And because people were getting shot by the police and military. And when we went, so we knew that that was the case, absolutely. And when we tried to speak to, you know, the doctors at the hospital, the only question we had was, can you confirm to us that it was bullet wounds, that they're bullets? And they just would not. And it was just so obvious, and everyone had the same story outside, the family members, all the witnesses, and they refused to even say that.
No, I mean, it continued, because after the massacres, I did with several other attorneys and students, a report with the University Network for Human Rights and Harvard Law School on the massacres, you know? And so we spent months and months and months interviewing people. The narrative stayed the same. People continued to be, like, the doctors were not helpful. Some said overtly racist. I was actually kind of surprised that they were so open about it, but there was just this, like, animosity towards indigenous folks at this, that still exists now, but they were very open about it. Usually they're a little, like, more reserved about their racism, but quite open about it. And, you know, what was interesting to me is, like I said, people were waking up from their comas and telling me what happened, and the story was so consistent between victims. You know, a lot of times victims, or people will talk amongst each other and stories will start to combine. These were people telling me, speaking for the first time, and the story was exactly the same. How the military brought the women, what they did is they said, bring the women to the front, and then they began attacking. It was shocking. One thing I remember from that night, sorry, I'm like giving a little story, but since we started talking about it, I'm thinking about it. There was a person who was shot in the eye, and he was like explaining to me what happened, and he was trying to help another person who had been shot by a soldier, and the soldiers were targeting people that were helping the injured, and he got shot in the eye. And he started crying out of the one eye that worked and said, you're going to see tomorrow, they're going to say we did this. They're going to blame us because we're Indians, because we're communists, because we're drug narco traffickers. This is what they're going to say. And the whole country is going to believe it. And I've been here. I've seen the racism. I see how the press can manipulate things. But it was such a clear massacre, I actually struggled to believe. Like, you can't believe this. Quite literally, zero police, zero soldiers were shot or killed or injured. Every single victim that day was one of the indigenous protesters. So I thought, how can you make that narrative believable? But that's what the press said. I mean, it was shocking. And it still upsets me that, like, he was so right about how it was explained by the government and by the
at least mainstream press in Bolivia.
Exactly, and it was a joint work that they did in order to paint that picture for, you know, in the national media and also, you know, for the entire Bolivian population, but for the exterior as well. They had Arturo Murillo, the former interior minister of Jeanine Áñez, go, you know, to, you know, stand at the podium at the interior ministry and give the press conference to those mainstream outlets saying exactly what had happened, that, you know, calling the indigenous campesinos terrorists and things like that, and saying that they did it to themselves. And that was reiterated over and over and over again. And we saw that, you know, played on television throughout the coup year. But you can go right now on YouTube and see the full videos and Facebook of UNITEL. You can see that stream and get that footage and download it in HD right now of literally Jeanine Áñez saying that they pacified the country or whatever, everything's fine. And that they literally have essentially B-roll of people being lined up like cattle, and all the people who weren't severely injured, and they're all like handcuffed to each other in a line and being shipped away in Wayani. So it's just absolutely shocking. To me, I've had to look at that since in order to look for those images. And it's absolutely unbelievable that this was able to happen and that anyone anywhere inside or outside of Bolivia could deny that.
It's bizarre. I mean, it was really one of the worst moments in my life doing human rights work, because it was just such a 180. Like, it was so clear. I've literally documented massacres on multiple continents, and this was one of the clearest massacres I've ever seen, ever. And yet, the dominant narrative was they shot themselves, which is bizarre. Who would sign up for that role? You can shoot me. You know, they were saying they were doing it to make the government look bad. It's absurd, but the footage exists. The footage exists of them shooting. The footage exists of them, like you said, lining people up, where they then tortured them in jail. I mean, the defense minister went on TV after Sankata and said, we didn't shoot a single bullet. But it's so bizarre, because all you have to do is type in Sankata on YouTube and you see military shooting. Like, it was just like such blatant lies, which anywhere else people would say, like, this is BS. But people bought it, and still people buy it today. Like, there's the elite class here still thinks, you know, the people in Sacaba shot themselves and the people in Sankata also shot themselves and wanted to blow up a plant. It's quite shocking.
Well, that's what they say. I don't think they actually believe that. I think that they are just outright fascists who are willing to repeat that lie over and over again because it serves them, that narrative serves them. But I can't imagine anyone believing that. Perhaps in the exterior, where people don't understand how things work in this country, but it's been very shocking. And unfortunately, the just one more thing, Ale, you know, there continue to be victims of Jeanine Áñez's crimes. Jeanine Áñez finally was jailed in March of 2021, you know, on pretrial detention. She finally was actually sentenced to 10 years, I believe, after a long period and many delays. But there are many people who suffered, you know, persecution. They were jailed arbitrarily. They were tortured. Their families experienced a lot of persecution. It was very difficult for them to provide for their families. It was mostly men who, you know, in large part of these communities, provide for their entire families. It was a very difficult time, and they had to live through the COVID lockdown and everything that took place then. And one of the comrades, who was the president of the Victims Association of Wayani Sacaba, just passed away recently. He was a leader in trying to demand, you know, justice for the families. He was injured, and a lot of people were paralyzed, disfigured, mutilated, and have experienced a lot of difficulties, permanently disabled, and finally, ultimately, due to complications, he passed away. It's very tragic.
Yeah, I mean, that's the really problematic part, is there's the official numbers of people who died, but since then, more people have died. Other people, there's, you know, allegedly were disappeared. There's folks, I mean, it's really hard, because folks live in the campo, so a lot of people that saw, like, for instance, this woman in Sankata who was shot that was never accounted for. They had brought bodies into the plant. Of course, the government denies this. But the official numbers, at the end of the day, they're actually probably higher than what we've seen. And people like Roberto, who you just mentioned, you know, I was just with his wife this last week. You know, he just recently died. People have had complications with these injuries because it's not scratched. This is like someone's intestines were exploded by bullets, and you know, people losing their legs. I mean, it's very gruesome things that happen.
Absolutely. Did you have something?
Yeah, I was saying we had another chat about another topic to do with the Bolivia coup, which we could talk about, from the username Kinky. saying, I hope the OAS can't invite any country to the next Summit of the Americas. And now, obviously, the role of the OAS is key in the whole history of the coup in Bolivia. But like, before we get into that, there's been the recent controversy around Luis Almagro. I mean, Camila, you've been following some of this story. What exactly happened with Luis Almagro? Why was he accused of impropriety recently?
Well, have you been following?
I have been following.
Okay. Well, he violated the norms of, you know, of his position by dating someone, seeing someone who is some sort of a secretary or worker beneath him at the OAS. And so, you know, there's a lot of ethical implications to that. What have you seen?
Yeah, I mean, he broke the rules.
And the ethics code.
Yes, and the irony in this is because one thing is what people do in their personal lives is in their personal lives. There were strict rules about abusing power and dating people. Particularly, this woman was, I think, a couple decades younger than him. You know, a very dominant, like a problematic power relationship. But also the irony is, he's the same person that didn't. I don't want to go into like all the specifics of like the OAS, but there's the Inter-American Commission that's part of it, and the executive secretary of the Inter-American Commission, who was exceptional during the coup, who did. Really, I honestly think saved people's lives in terms of speaking.
Paulo Brau,
in terms of speaking out against the accusers.
He is, by the way, a fan of Causete News.
Yeah, we just saw him in Brazil when I was doing my coverage at a Lula event.
Okay. Anyway, you know, the way it works at the Inter-American Commission is the executive secretary, the commissioners decide this, but the secretary general of the OAS basically signs the dotted line, and it's just a formality. Every single executive secretary is basically reelected, and the secretary general has nothing to do with it. Well, at the 11th hour, quite literally something like 11 o'clock on the last day where he was supposed to continue the next day, he didn't sign it. He basically said, no, there's been all this impropriety during his leadership. And the way he spoke about it was kind of implying like there was, you know, exploitive relationships, which didn't happen. But Almagro allowed that kind of lie to grow and grow and grow. And now it's kind of come back bite him because he's actually doing what he tried to imply someone else did. So, you know, this guy is he's a very problematic figure. I wrote a book on the coup and I spoke to some folks at the OAS more off the record. And look, he's, as they said, a cucaracha. He'll do whatever he needs to do to stay in power. And this is a lot of what fed this kind of fraud narrative that I think we're about to talk about.
And I think Camila recently found out that Luis Almagro is actually the same age as, is it Nicolas Maduro and Luis Arce, right?
Mm-hmm.
Think about that. Who looks better? Who looks better at this age? Luis Arce, Nicolas Maduro, or Luis Almagro? I think there's not really much comparison there.
Yeah, and I mean, we try not to pay a whole lot of attention, and we have in the case of Bolivia, to these human rights reports necessarily. The reason, of course, being that, you know, I have spent a lot of time reporting on Venezuela, Nicaragua, and Cuba, and these have been used to call for regime change. They've been used to destabilize countries, and, you know, they're not credible, particularly when they come from this sort of, like, human rights industrial complex that is based in Washington, although a lot of our friends work as human rights defenders, such as yourself, and some of our mutual friends. And so we do think that, you know, the work is very important, and we do follow it, and we do read these reports. But that was actually instrumental. The report that came from the Inter-American Commission of Human Rights, which is a part of the OAS, actually, like you said, did a job here in Bolivia, coming here immediately after the massacres of Sincata and Sacaba, conducting an investigation, speaking to those victims and others as well, such as in the city of Cochabamba and other places where there was violence, paramilitary violence, and other things that took place in October and November 2019. And they wrote that report, and it actually had an impact both within the country and outside. And so, you know, we've reported on that, we've referred to that, and I think it has been very important in clarifying the events because in a time like a coup, which is such a sensitive time, a difficult time for people to arrive here, to get those interviews, there were only so many of us that were speaking to victims, and they actually did come and speak in here from victims and collect those testimonies and compile them, and that's why it was so significant that he was removed.
No, I mean, I think he was punished for doing what he did. I think he saved lives. He didn't sit in Washington, D.C. like a lot of the mainstream human rights institutions that, as you mentioned, I mean, like,
they disproportionately focus on leftist countries. Their coverage in the Americas, for instance, like Human Rights Watch, has been widely criticized all over the Americas, not even like from within countries like Venezuela. More kind of centrist countries have said, whoa, you guys, you know, like they'll focus on Honduras, or sorry, Nicaragua. Meanwhile, next door in Honduras, there's a quite literal dictatorship with the highest homicide rate in the world and, you know, utter silence. So certainly they've been politicized and weaponized. Human rights has certainly been weaponized. But the Inter-American Commission, when they came down following the massacres, it really changed. They moved the dial. It changed things. And honestly, there weren't massacres after. I think the interesting and scary part is the government saw, okay, we can't get away with these big explosive things. So the new strategy kind of morphed into, we're just going to keep arresting critics, including journalists, including politicians, including human rights defenders. And so they weren't doing the things that would get coverage, big headline coverage, but they were doing, they just kind of changed their form of repression over the next, you know, the following months.
Right. And so during that year, there were several instances of sort of uprising, protests, blockades, particularly in El Alto and in Cochabamba and Caracara, where we have interviewed people. And those people were detained arbitrarily just for, you know, standing, you know, at one of those bloqueos, one of those road protests. And they were, you know, demanding things like, you know, an end to the lockdown. They wanted to resume work. Just, you know, they were saying that prices were too high. Different issues, some of which, you know, they would protest on any day, but because it was the coup and because there was a sort of martial law, people were just getting arrested for any which reason. And it was a very difficult process for them because there weren't these, you know, lawyers to come and help them and defend them. And they had great difficulty receiving visits from their wives and children. And they weren't released until 2 years ago, when Luis Arce returned back to power.
Yeah, I mean, I spent so many of these days in the jails until I was no longer allowed to go in, until allegedly, you know, I was put on the list by Murillo of seditious people that was going to get arrested for sedition or terrorism. So they went after anybody who was an opponent. And this is the scary part, because the narrative in the international community was totally, they didn't see this. I remember I spoke to this woman who survived the dictatorships here, and she was crying to me. She worked at a news station, I won't mention because they got attacked a lot, but she said, she was crying and telling me, like, this is worse than the dictatorships, because at least during the dictatorships, everybody knew it was a dictatorship. Right now, we're being repressed like we were during the dictatorships, but the international community sees this, like, blonde woman who's sweet and nice and thinks, ah, this is, everything's good. There was no coup. There's no repression. Yes, she was, yes, exactly. I think it was Fortune magazine. Maybe it was Forbes, but it was shocking. And the thing is, they went after everyone who, not just opponents, but that they perceived as opponents. So, like, there was a journalist, I remember, I went to the jail with him, and he literally owned the website, the domain where a website published an article criticizing Áñez. And he was arrested for terrorism simply for owning the domain. Like, this is how far they went after people. It wasn't just, like, the really outspoken leaders. It was anybody they perceived as an enemy, they went after them. They were MAS, they were, you know, communists, they were Castro Chavista, and they went to jail. Or they were beaten up, or they were, you know, if they worked at radio stations or television stations, their signal was cut and they were shut down. I mean, this was a dictatorship. I've worked in dictatorships. I can tell you, this was a dictatorship. But the whole world seemed to think, or at least much of the world seemed to think, something else was going on here.
I just wanted to add one thing. If we're talking about the OAS, and obviously there's an unequal access as well to these kinds of international organizations. You know, for people you work with in El Alto, obviously they, you know, it's much more difficult for people like them to access international NGOs, etc. But in the US, there is a circle of Bolivians who do have access to a lot of power. People who are exiled, you know, from Bolivia, who are wanted for human rights abuses, corruption, etc., from the neoliberal period. Can you tell us a little bit about that circle and that sort of circle of power, people like Goni, where they are, who they are, and like who what sort of power they have access to there in the US and specifically in Washington as well?
Yeah, I mean, ironically, I actually think that was some of the most dangerous pieces of this coup. So you have people like Arturo Murillo, who goes on television calling, you know, anybody who's an enemy, an animal, and they will hunt you down and, you know,
really just overtly oppressive. I mean, even pre-coup, he was talking about, like, during this debate on abortion, he said, you know, anyone who wants an abortion should climb up to the roof and jump off and kill themselves. You know, like, he's just un bruto, you know? And so he wasn't particularly helpful for the coup. But then you have folks that are, you know, the professional class that are doing their basically lobbying in the United States, in D.C., these folks who've left because they didn't like, at the end of the day, an indigenous leader, or, you know, far right-wing folks that wanted kind of this free market exploitive economy that they've had up until, you know, just about a decade and a half ago. They were incredibly effective during the coup. They were lobbying folks, and the folks they were lobbying were not Republicans. You know, the right-wing, the Republicans in the United States are already, like, they're on board. So they spent a lot of time doing, you know, lobbying Democrats, lobbying institutions like Human Rights Watch or OAS to really normalize what was happening. And they ultimately, I think, ended up, they are the ones that gave this coup a different face. And they also, excuse me, collaborated with U.S. institutions. So I should mention, there's an organization, CLS Strategies, in the United States.
That's a company.
Right? It's a company. So Añez's government hired this U.S. firm, like, basically, and they work for generally for Democrats, this firm, and they were hired to rebrand their image in terms of human rights, democracy, and elections. And they were the first company punished by Facebook for spreading fake news and creating fake accounts. They basically, I mean, when the coup happened, the week of the coup, the Inter-American Commission found that there was something called 1 million+, you know, fake Twitter accounts and tweets saying, like, no, there was no coup, or it was fraud. So all this messaging was quite literally paid for by Añez, but also coordinated in D.C. and coordinated with, you know, between here and D.C., but actually was radically effective. It was incredibly effective. I should mention that the CLS Strategies, also there were members of this group that were part of the team that elected Goni in 2002. There's a documentary called Our Brand is Crisis about how Goni won. These same players. Same players in Goni's government and Añez's government. There's a person, Jaime Aparicio, the ambassador to the OAS. Same kind of stuff, and really spun this narrative that we're the good guys. Evo's this narco-comunista doing all these bad things. And boy, the U.S. bought it. It was shocking.
Yeah, and there's actually, they made a film. The original Our Brand is Crisis is a documentary. You can find it online. You can watch the whole thing if you type it on Google. Our Brand is Crisis 2005 documentary, and it's really interesting because it shows you the inside of the campaigns in the neoliberal era, where the US advisors will tell them what narrative to take. And then they made a film about it with Sandra Bullock, which is not very good. I watched it on a plane here when I came here once. It's not very good. But some of those people are still around, right? There's that bull guy in the Our Brand is Crisis. What's his name? He's quite famous.
James Carville.
Who is he?
I mean, most of these folks were Democratic pollsters. They worked for the Democrats. So again, this is like notion that the like Republicans are the only bad guys out there is obviously silly. And at the end of the day, yes, I mean, the reason this documentary is called Our Brand is Crisis is because James Carville and some of these folks that ultimately ended up working for Añez came down, and Goni was wildly unpopular. And so they were like, look, the only way you're going to win is we're going to create a fake crisis. And that was his campaign. Look, we're going into crisis. I've already been president. Yes, I'm the only guy who's been president, so I at least can help us avoid this crisis. And so he won, you know, just ever so slightly. It was by like literally 1%. And then, you know, months later, carried out multiple massacres and then fled to the U.S. and currently lives in the U.S., unfortunately. But these, you know, these are Democratic strategists that helped get these folks into power and then helped cover up the coup behavior of Añez in 2019.
Yeah, well, I mean, the one thing about how many victims, going back to the Añez coup, that she had was that it does sort of perhaps ensure that something like this won't happen again, because during that period in which she was being tried or supposed to be tried, and the trial period was supposed to begin, but it was delayed, there were countless protests, both outside of the Miraflores prison where she was being held, or is being held now, I guess, and outside of the different court buildings where the proceedings were supposed to be taking place. And, you know, without fail, when the social movements were convoking these demonstrations, people would show up at 10 in the morning, at 5 in the evening, they would stay all day. And that's how I met a lot of La Paz faces, because, of course, we've been living in the Tropico, so we don't necessarily, you know everyone in La Paz. But there are so many people who day in and day out were there. And, you know, I met one person who was you know, another victim of, like we said, political persecution. She was not famous. She's not a MAS funcionario. She's, you know, not a known person. But on mere suspicion of being a MAS person or MAS supporter, she was rounded up during what was supposed to be the lockdown or whatever, because she was out and about, I think, running an errand and going to the store or something, and they said that she couldn't be out. And she argued, and then they just took her to jail. I mean, it was just that.
Yeah, no, I mean, this is the thing is that one, they weaponized COVID. They used that to go after whoever. And it was like served as a smokescreen. Because again, the international, eventually, like, the House of Cards started collapsing. People started to see, wait, this is not the democracy they're talking about. But the COVID served as a smokescreen, and it allowed them to send the military in the streets and without as much criticism, at least initially. But like you said, it's the perception. The racism's so deep here that you're indigenous, oh, you must be a MAS supporter, which is not always the case. There are many indigenous people that don't support the MAS, but anybody they perceived as a political enemy must be MAS. Again, you guys must be MAS. I must be MAS. Anybody who said, hey, maybe you shouldn't massacre people at Sacaba is sufficient to be subversive or the MAS.
Absolutely. And so did you guys, I don't know if you guys touched on what's happening with Arturo Murillo, who we mentioned, Añez's interior minister during the coup. He fled to the United States. I'm not sure if we have confirmed whether or not he got to Brazil or Panama or was anywhere in between, but there's a whole case against him right now in the U.S. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually really good timing that we're talking about this. So Arturo Murillo, which was the interior minister, he was, a lot of people think he was kind of, I shouldn't say brains behind the operation, but at least the heavy-handed person in this coup government, quite violent person. Following the election, the win in 2020 of Lucho Arce, he fled to the United States. And he was arrested in the United States for soborno, bribery, and money laundering. He had bought weapons that he, you know, ultimately ended up using against the people illegally, for, you know, inflated prices, and stole all this money from the state during a pandemic, I should add, and is currently in jail in the United States facing trial. Tomorrow, ironically, he is his court date, in which he's stated that he will be pleading guilty. So he will ultimately end up going to jail for some, hopefully quite some time in the United States. There was also other Bolivian officials named in this, and there's one official that they haven't named publicly, but he was a high-level official in the defense ministry.
It was Fernando Lopez.
Yeah, I mean, all the, like, signs point to the former defense minister, Lopez, who fled to Brazil and is currently in Brazil. Hopefully, you know, knock on wood, if Lula wins, he will be extradited, hopefully to Bolivia before the United States, but he needs to be processed as well. These are the people that really kind of masterminded the massacres and the worst abuses during Añez.
Absolutely. Well, I don't think that's going to happen. Brazil is a very large country, and there are very large pockets of, you know, these right-wing landowners. It really wouldn't matter who is in power. And, of course, those are the people who are protecting him. And that's where Añez was trying to flee to when she was caught, you know, under the sort of sofa bed box. She was trying to get to Brazil because she knew that there would be people there that would harbor her, not necessarily the Bolsonaro government. Of course, he wouldn't extradite her anyways, but there are a lot of, you know, yeah, right-wing groups there that would have taken care of her.
Yeah, well, that's, I think it's really interesting why Arturo Murillo went to Miami rather than, like, just literally any other country, because the crime he did, the reason the U.S. are going for him now is not because of corruption as a general idea, it was because his, it took, part of the crime took place in the, within the United States, so. But Fernando Lopez, he's in Brazil. He's happy. Like, at the end of the day, as Camilla says, you can literally hide just like in like on someone's land or something. And who's going to get you? So why do you think Arturo Murillo had to come to Miami rather than just going to Brazil or any Latin American country that had a right-wing government?
You know, it's hard to say. I think in part because Murillo's just kind of a wildly, you know, he's known to be an arrogant guy, and I think he thought he's intocable, untouchable. But also South Florida has a really quite friendly population to fascists. So a bunch of right-wing folks that were probably sympathetic to his views, he felt like home. He went home. Basically, South Miami in many ways is home for a person like Arturo Murillo.
Yeah, I mean, there must be, obviously, Miami, Cubans, Venezuelans, large community. But is there a lot of, like, Bolivians as well? Bolivians of people who would have taken in Arturo Murillo, people like, who were the people he was involved with in this case, these arms dealers, etc.?
Yeah, I mean, they're based out of South Florida. Same with the mercenaries that Lopez had hired and brought to Bolivia during the 2020 elections. They're all in South Florida. But also people like Sanchez Brosain, who was the defense minister under Goni. He's known as the butcher of El Alto. You know, I should mention that, like, Bolivia's a relatively, at least compared to a lot of neighboring countries, non-violent country. And there's been really two very large exceptions since Bolivia became a democracy 40 years ago, roughly. 2003, which was when Goni was in power and Sanchez Brosain was his defense minister. That was the deadliest month in Bolivia's democratic history. And then November 2019. And so they're the same players. Those who fled, home is really South Florida. It's been the home for a lot of really pretty nefarious characters. And like I said, people like Sanchez Brosain are there. Lizárraga, the minister of, ¿cómo se llama la palabra? The foreign affairs minister, the minister of communications, I think had all fled to South Florida as well.
Okay. Well, I think we should probably wrap that up. Obviously, this has been quite an experimental affair, so to speak. This is our first ever live stream. We're going to go, like, you know, developing the format as we go. This is going to be every week, so Wednesday, Thursday, and we're really excited how this is going to develop.
Yeah, it was more of a live version of what we already started recently, which is Latin America Review, our podcast, which we largely have interviewed sort of Latin American leaders and, you know, different people from different countries. But we wanted to start this live stream so that we could kind of talk more about current events and not necessarily with, you know, vice ministers or anything like that. Because there's a lot of things going on, you know, every day, and we don't really have the sort of platform to be able to talk about it. And so I think it's been great. We've been wanting to interview you for a really long time. And I think that given that we still have November ahead of us, we have lots to talk about, and I know that you'll be back here in Bolivia, and we'll be here as well on November 15th, as well as November 19th, when we remember the martyrs of Sencata and Sacaba on that three-year anniversary.
Yeah, what was it? I just wanted to ask Thomas one last question. Have the señoras attacked you this time around? So basically, Thomas is quite a known person within Bolivia because he does a lot of interviews on different media channels. And in certain middle-class areas of Bolivia, the señoras, or I guess that would translate to the Karen of the middle-class areas of La Paz, often identify him, often shout very nasty things to him. Has that happened this time around?
So one person has said something, but I've not been attacked. So I've sometimes been, like, quite literally physically attacked. And it's by, yes, Karens, soccer moms. Occasionally, like during the coup, there was a lot of the, like, upper-class women would have their indigenous workers sew La Resistencia in their jackets. They have, like, matching jackets. I mean, it was just absurd. And, I mean, certainly, like, I have been attacked by kind of the motoqueros, these kind of parastate groups, which is actually problematic. I mean, it's the equivalent of maybe, like, the Proud Boys. And that is a bit scarier. You know, like, they actually, like, fight. But then when the soccer moms come up and then kind of, like, hit and say nasty things about how I, you know, love Indians and or I'm communist... it's a pretty persistent thing, shockingly. But this time I have not been beat up by any Karens or attacked by any Karens. Knock on wood. I still haven't left La Paz yet, so we'll see how it goes.
Long may that continue. Well, thank you for everyone who's watched and commented for a large live chat. And yeah, thank you. We look forward to seeing you next week as well.
Next week, we'll be speaking about Brazil, of course. We're going to the second round of Brazil's elections, the runoff between Lula and Bolsonaro. I'll be back in Sao Paulo, which is basically the most important and the key state in all of Brazil, but also currently since his teens, Lula's home state, where he'll be meeting with unions and other important sectors ahead of the election. So we'll have that for you and a stream as well.
Great.
Thanks, guys.
Hello.
The Karens, that's like the best...